Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring, ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoice.
Ashe. We'll pour to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know, as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places, learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God," or "Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more! We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths." We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names. Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Davis Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, John
Henry Clark, John
Dr. Khaled
Jackson,
Muhammad.
Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name. Ashe.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
The 2020 election isn't a few weeks away. It's already here. Millions of Americans are already voting. Make sure you stand up and join them. There will always be reasons to think your vote doesn't matter. That's not new. What is new is a growing movement for justice, equality, and progress on so many issues. This really is a tipping point, and that momentum only continues if we win this election. But it's going to be close. It could come down to a handful of voters just like you. So I'm asking you to bring this thing home. Leave no doubt. Vote early.
In my soul, don't see no light when I'm wide awake. I'm sick of working for no ends. You see the green made me feel hay, and there's no turning back. What? Keep a name for my past, but well, the feeling always lasts. I don't think you know me, know me, no. You don't know my life, my heart, my soul. See the things I see.
Black women hurt, black women curse, black brothers doing black women dirt, black women crying, black women murk. We can never put a black woman first. Black lives matter, black lives scatter, black eyes under black eyeshadow, black blood made a black lives splatter, black sister had a black lives shadow, black single mother, black favorite color, black brother made a black woman suffer, black woman down, black woman under. We contribute to the black woman struggle, black women brave, black women save, black women lost, black women fade, black man with a black woman made, black pain made a black woman change, black woman cry, black woman tired, tears running down a black woman's eyes, black women run, black women hide, black violence made a black woman die, black woman pass, black mama sad, black pride all a black woman had, black rage for the black woman mad, black men calling black women trash, black women hurt, let you back in, black women keep protecting black men don't protect the black queen, black women always get the back seat, black women preach, black women teach, black soil for the black women sees, black pain all the black women sees, black loves all the black women needs.
Whoa!
vision, black intervention, black women faith, black women blessings, black man keep the black queen protected, black women save, black women save, black businesses are black women paid, black don't crack, black don't age, black women proud, black women praise, black women smiling, black women shining, black women got it, black women riding, black wealth, no more back to the bottom, black kings get a black woman diamonds, black women body, black women climbing, black women body, black women popping, black man keep the black women on it, black roses planted back in a garden, black loyalty, black royalty, black novelty, black odyssey, black women in the black colony, black women feeling black harmony, black for the people, black women peaceful, black man treat you, black women equal, backbone with a black woman teach you, black strength when a black woman feed you, black pride, that's what's happening now, black man holding black women down, black women getting cash and I'm proud, black angels and they trapped in the clouds, black women preach, black women teach, black soil for the black woman sees, black pains all a black woman sees, black loves all a black woman needs.
Shows growing up as a kid were The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and Family Matters. Now, aside from them being both classic sitcoms and hilarious, both shows centered around families that I wish I could have been a part of. See, neither the Banks nor the Winslows were perfect. They each had their fair share of problems, and they argued, but they always seemed to settle their disagreements by sitting down, talking to each other, and coming up with solutions that benefit all the people involved. My family is not like the sitcoms. Growing up in my house was like waking up every day in a minefield. We had to be cautious and walk carefully around our issues or everything would start to explode. My family has a basement full of damaged memories and closets overflowing with empty liquor bottles echoing secrets. I've heard whispers of cheating husbands and abortions, but they always seem to get swept under the rug. And I suppose this is how I learned to be a hoarder. How I was taught to gather all this hurt but still keep it hidden from everyone. My family says not every story belongs on a stage. Says the narrative we give should only focus on the good moments. When I broke character and tried to overdose, they closed the curtain. When I wrote poems about being abused, they tried to cut my mic off. When I told my story anyways, my father said I needed to act right. And my father, such a bold character, is he that walking demolition? I still don't know if he is a proud man filled with stubborn and anger or a troubled boy who buries his fear in the palm of his hands. I've watched him as he bulldozes his fist through every hallway of every house. And I hold the days when I can tell myself, at least it's not my mother this time. At least he never got to me. And I can only hope that the holes in the wall will serve as some type of metaphor for all the pain trying to escape. But mommy doesn't like a messy home, so we hang picture frames all over the house and say, look at how happy we are in the photo. Don't pick it up. It looks perfect, exactly where it is. And despite all the destruction behind us, we just keep smiling. We keep silent. We just keep cleaning up the mess and pretending this is normal. We hide it all. All the pain, all the secrets, all the tears, all the fighting, all the bruises. My family is not sitcom material, but we do know how to play our parts. We memorize our lines. We stay in character. We stick to the script and never expose what happens behind the scenes. I used to want a family like the ones I saw on TV. I wanted to be happy like the Banks or the Winslows. And then I realized It's just a TV show. But maybe my family is like theirs. They're all actors.
Just like you are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hello, hello. Happy Saturday.
Hey, Josh Jermaine.
Hey, Dr. Rogers. Hello, local listeners in the world. And happy Halloween. I want to thank you all for being here. For my regulars, you know how it goes. And for my newbies, we like to start the show off paying respect to our ancestors. Today's ancestral profile will focus on Jane M. Boland, the first Black woman judge. Jane Boland became the first Black woman to break down many barriers during her life. However, the title for which she holds the most recognition is that of the first Black woman judge in the country. Using her position from the bench as a family court judge, Boland fought against racial discrimination within the system and was a fierce advocate for children, particularly children of color, whose cases she oversaw. Boland's story of legal service and general activism begins at home. Born on April 11, 1908, in Poughkeepsie, and please don't quote me on this because I don't even know how to say that word, but New York. Her father, J.S.C. Boland, was the first Black graduate of Williams College and had his own legal practice. Boland was also the founding member of the local NAACP and later in life became the first Black president of the Dutchess County Bar Association. According to the New York Times, Boland fell in love with her father's leather-bound law book and decided to do her part as she became more and more aware of the articles and pictures of lynching that the NAACP's official publication, Crisis Magazine, published. It is easy to imagine how a young, protected child who sees portrayals of brutality is forever scarred and becomes determined to contribute in her own small way to social justice. She called in a letter around the time of her retirement in 1978. Boland would go on to continue her studies at West Lesley College, this prestigious private women's liberal arts college in Massachusetts. She was one of the two Black freshmen attending the school, where racism was so rampant and they so ostracized that the two of them opted to move off campus. Despite the trials that Boland faced, she graduated in 1928 as one of the top students and was named a West Lesley Scholar. Even though West Lesley acknowledged her brilliance as a student, when she spoke to a guidance counselor at the school about a possible law career, she was told that there was little opportunity for women in law and absolutely none for a colored woman. Even her own father discouraged the notion at first, according to the Times, although he emphasized that lawyers had to grapple with the most unpleasant and sometimes grossest kind of human behavior. However, once he saw that his daughter's mind was made up, the older Boland would throw his financial and moral support behind her to help her accomplish her goals. Jane Boland would be accepted into Yale Law School, where she would ultimately become the first Black woman to earn her law degree from the esteemed institution. She would later become the first Black woman to join the New York City Bar Association. After her graduation, Boland apprenticed in her father's law office, dismissed by local law firms due to her gender and likely also her race. She later went on to practice law with her first husband, Ralph E. Mizell, who later died in 1943. 2 years later, in ceremony at the World's Fair, which had just opened, she would be appointed and sworn in as a judge of the Domestic Relations Court, now called Family Court. By then, New York City Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia, filling her title as the first Black judge. As a judge, Bolin led the charge and change of breaking down racial barriers and segregation within the system she was a part of. She led the charge of requiring child care agencies that got public funding to accept children regardless of their race or ethnicity. She also ended the practice of assigning probation officers based on race and religion. Despite breaking down barriers and crashing through ceilings, Bolin remained focused on her work, dismissing the fuss that people usually make about her trailblazing ways. Everyone else makes a fuss about it, but I didn't about it, and I still don't, she told the New York Times in a 1993 interview. I wasn't concerned about first, second, or last. My work was my primary concern. Bolin would be reappointed to her seat by three more mayors for three more 10-year terms. She only stepped down from the bench when she reached the mandatory retirement age of 70 in 1978 and wasn't too happy about it either, quipping, "They are kicking me out." Still, even after retiring at the age of 70, Bolin continued to advocate for children's rights and education. She volunteered as a tutor at New York City public schools for about 2 years post-retirement and ultimately went on to serve on the New York State Board of Regents. When she died on January 8, 2007, at the age of 98, she left behind a legacy of a fierce advocate who, despite remaining focused on the work, carved out a decisive path for the representation in the legal system today, including the unprecedented number of Black women who were sworn in as judges in Harris County, Texas last year. Wonderful, wonderful. Let's lift Ms. Bolin up in power. May she rest in peace. What a wonderful, wonderful, phenomenal woman. My God. My God today. What a wonderful, wonderful woman. Mm-hmm. And much needed in the justice system.
Amen. How you feeling? I share that. I'm doing pretty good, though. Hello, everyone. My name is Joshua Lane, the true mystical prophet who always brings the hidden truth to light. I am thankful to be here with all our listeners this Saturday to discuss the impact that trauma silencing affects not only the future generations of children, but the parents they become to their own children. I feel that this discussion is important because I've heard these stories from people I know personally to people I work with in the community. I just think that I'm just thankful that we have a platform here where we're able to discuss this and be open and honest because we need to talk about it. You know, silencing in our community is the epidemic. It is the pandemic. So I'm glad that we're able to at least have a groundwork so that we're able to not only acknowledge the problem, but we can try to find some solutions. But that's going to come with telling the unauthored truth. But I'm glad to be back, and I can't wait to get into this discussion.
Okay, okay. You know this is going to be a happy Saturday. This is going to be a real good Saturday, and I cannot wait to hear what will be unfolded on this show. So thank you all for joining us on Black Sister Talk. I am Ms. Wanda, your therapist's favorite therapist, giving you yet another unfiltered, candid conversation. Today's conversation is long overdue, and it beckons the attention of our community. Trauma silencing. Our children have to come to a complete halt as it manifests into generational trauma. If you are unsure of what I mean by this, simply put, let's be the change we want to see in the world by becoming active instead of a bystander to our children's pain. So let's unleash, unlock, and redefine what it means to break cycles and build mental wealth, not only for ourselves on today, but our internal family system. So without further ado, let's breathe. Josh, can you please introduce today's guest?
Of course I can. Today we have a special guest in Monique that's chiming in on this discussion today, on this important dialogue today on how trauma silencing has impacted her life in her own personal way. I think that she's a great person for this discussion because I think she has a story to tell for people. And I think when you hear about these stories about trauma silencing, we never look at how the child is being doubted, what they already know to be true, and how that affects the psyche, how that affects the person overall being, how that affects how she sees herself as a woman, how she sees herself, how she deals with her children. So until further ado, allow Monique, just please, are you there, Monique? Are you online right now?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, well, please share your story, you know, and hopefully everybody listening though can hear it out. So explain how trauma silencing has affected your life.
Okay, well, again, my name is Monique.
Hold on, Miss Monique. Hey, Miss Monique. I want to say what's up to you first because I have had the pleasure to sit down, you know, not sit down, but talk to you, which has been great. And so I just want to thank you for taking the time out on this Saturday to come on Black Sister Talk and talk to us about your story. It's a very sacred to us as well as you, and I want to make sure you're respected this entire time. So if you ever feel uncomfortable, please let me know, okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And I thank you guys for inviting me on. And can you hear me good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Well, my background with trauma silencing comes from the family that I was raised, that I was born and raised in. And I was about 16. I was actually 16 when I told on my uncle, my great uncle-in-law, for sexually abusing me. And when I told, at the time, I was under the impression that I was the only person that he had been sexually abusing. And I think that that's very important to note, because further on in the story, you will hear me mention how when I told, it wasn't the first time that they heard this or that he was accused. So that's something to just keep in mind. So when I told, like I said, I was 16, and he had started molesting me when I was about 8 years old, but I didn't remember because when you're abused sexually, or I believe any type of abuse, when it happens very young, you have a tendency to repress it or to block it out because the mind is just not able to handle it at that time. And so I was being abused by him when I was younger for a few years, and then when I turned 16, I was not going for it, and I decided to speak up for myself. So when I did, like I said, I thought that it was just me. And then once I started to tell, and the word got around, then other people in my family started to come up to me or started to call, or when I saw them, they would say things like, oh, well, it happened to me too. And I was like, huh? So I was honestly pissed. I was not just pissed. I was irate because I was like, so you all knew that this has been happening and nobody did anything. And then furthermore, you all allow other children to go over there. That really hurt my feelings because it just kind of sent me a message that I wasn't worthy of being protected. And it just kind of said, it didn't sit well with me. So then after I started to hear other people's stories and other people told me that these other people were abused. And so I went and spoke to those people. And I kind of went on my own investigative journey trying to figure out why no one did anything. And in the process of even doing that, I was also on another investigative journey. Well, no, I wouldn't say investigative. I was just on another journey of trying to get myself some help because the person who was abusing me, he kept coming up to me at other people's houses, trying to talk to me. So not only was I abused by this person, not only did I tell and I wasn't believed and nothing happened, but then he was allowed to come around me still and nobody did anything. So what that would look like is we would have family gatherings, family get-togethers, and he would just come up to me and grab my hand, and he would, you know, ask me questions or say something to me or try to apologize. And nobody would say, like, hey, you're not supposed to be touching her or you shouldn't be around her. And I'm pretty sure people listening are like, why wasn't he even in jail? Well, because they silenced me, my family, and basically told me to be quiet about it, don't say anything. I got accused of lying about it. But the crazy thing about predators who do these things frequently is they do pretty much the same thing. They start with their victims at the same age, kind of. So that was my experience. That's my family's experience. And so I just, the more I learned, the more it didn't sit well with me as to why am I telling and no one's doing anything when this is not the first, second, third, fourth, fifth time that you all have heard this. You've heard this quite a bit of times over the past 40 years because the person is very old. And so I just didn't get it. I was like, well, what's happening here? So then it got to the point where, you know, I continued to tell, and it got to the point where I heard, you can't come over here. Not that I would even want to go over to the person's house naturally. You don't want to be around the person, but he's married to my aunt, my grandmother's sister. So I had a relationship with her before I told, and that was ruined. So I couldn't go over her house anymore. I couldn't talk to her anymore. I couldn't even speak to her. Mind you, I'm 16. I couldn't speak to her. And then other family members who kind of sided with her and with him, they were like, okay, well, you can't speak to us either. You can't call our house either. You can't come over either. And I'm talking about for family gatherings where for 16 years of my life, I've been coming around, obviously, because I've been in the damn family. So I'm like, what's going on here once again? And it was kind of like a undertone of, we know what's going on, but we're not going to talk about it. I did not agree with that. So it really upset me because I was like, where's the backbone of the people? Where are the men in the family? Why aren't the women speaking up when this has happened to them? And then, you know, as time went on and as he started to come around to my grandmother's house, he became to act sexually inappropriate in front of everybody. But nobody said anything. I mean, he was making sexual, just sexual jokes in front of everybody, revealing things that he had done to people and with people in the family sexually, because he also has substance abuse problems with alcohol. And so he would just go around pretty much just like being very vulgar and very nasty, and nobody would say anything. Some people would laugh it off, and then a few people would leave because they were embarrassed. And so I was made to feel then like I did not belong. Like I was not supposed to be around, like people didn't want me around. I was called a troublemaker. I was told that I messed up the family. And I think that because I'm just a little bit nervous about being, you know, on air, that I'm kind of condensing it down a little bit. And as I go on, I'll get comfortable, more comfortable. But it's way worse than what I'm telling right now, because I'm 31 now. So that was like 15, 16 years ago. But the effects that it has had on my life because of the way that they silenced me, it wasn't just silencing me within the family. Then the narrative had to go around that Monique is crazy. So in order to discount what I was saying, now I have to be looked at as crazy. And then because I already had past trauma with my mother and not being wanted by her, being given up by her, all before the age of 5, I didn't have a solid foundation or background as far as just the first 5 years of my life. It wasn't really stable. So for me to have this type of background, I already had traumatic issues. And so that did cause me in some ways to withdraw from others. It's something called reactive attachment disorder. So I really did not really gravitate to people as much socially. I like to be by myself a lot. And that's also a part of my personality. And so I was already being looked at as, to me, in my opinion, my experience, the child who nobody wanted. So she's over there. And I just didn't feel like I fit in with my sister or some of my other cousins. And I just always felt weird. So I already had just little, you know, trauma situations going on. And so when I told about this situation, it just kind of made everything way worse. And now I became the villain. Now I became the person who's messing up the family. Now I'm crazy. So now I have to be institutionalized because I won't stop telling on this person. Now I have to be put on medication because I'm talking about this situation and it's depressing me because I'm not understanding why nobody's doing anything. Because see, I was told when I was younger, if somebody touches you, you're supposed to tell. So then when I did tell and nothing happened, I was trying to figure out what sense does this make? And then he was caught, not once but twice, trying to touch me and talk to me in front of pretty much whoever was right there at the house. And even still then, with that being seen by my grandmother and by another family friend or family member, they didn't, nothing happened. I was always looked at as the villain. There were things like, I was living with my grandmother, and so he was the handyman in the family. And so he was always available, always there, always fixing things. So I remember a few times I woke up early in the morning at about 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. And my grandmother was like, you have to leave because Richard's just getting ready to come over and, you know, fix something. Or he's getting ready to come over and take me somewhere. And I'm like, so I have to leave? You know what I mean? So so basically my family, not basically, but my family chose him over me. And that type of betrayal still to this day is what causes me to have the traumatic issues that I still have. Because not only was I sexually molested by this person, but then I was rejected when I told the truth. I was rejected when I told in general. And then I was made to look like the villain, made to look crazy, called a liar. Then I was put on, they tried to put me on medication. And I became the mascot of, you messed up the family. And I was just trying to figure out, because I think, you know, I think that the way that I think is pretty rational. I think it makes sense. So if I tell and then I find out that he's been doing this to other people, this is not the first time you all have heard this. So naturally, I'm thinking somebody's going to do something. Nobody did anything. They just told me to stop telling and everything that I named previously. And so it really hurt my feelings a lot. The other victims in the family, my mother, my aunt, a cousin, all of those people were almost like afraid to talk about this as much as I was in front of other people and then to even report it. So when I would go around my family members who've also been abused by this person, they would all talk about it amongst the group, amongst just all of us in that moment. But if I was to say, hey, can you come to the police with me? Or hey, can you talk to Child Protective Services with me? Or hey, can you go to court with me or something? Can you help me do something? Can you write a letter to the district attorney? Nothing. So we would all sit and acknowledge this together. And even family members who heard about the situations and who said, I will never let my kids go there, even they wouldn't help me. So then that sent me another message. What is it about me that nobody will help me, but they made sure their kids and their grandkids didn't go there? Was I fed to the damn slaughter or something? And I found out that I was. I know that's something that family members are listening now, they may not want to hear. I don't care, because if they put me in this fucked up predicament for this long, and I'm still to this very day being treated foul because of it, I think everybody deserves to know the truth. My family allowed this man to molest and rape everybody, well, the women in the family. Nobody did anything to stop it. Some people before me told and they were silenced as well. And my aunt is 6 feet under, not just because of that, but that contributed to a lot of it. Because when this type of thing, when this type of situation happens in a family and no one says anything or protects you, it does send messages to you. And everybody is not as strong as some people are. Everybody deals with trauma differently. And when other things have happened, other contributing factors, just being in a dysfunctional family, period, is a lot. But when you add sexual abuse, when you add neglect, when you add abandonment, when you add being ostracized and being talked about because you decided to stand up for yourself and tell your truth, it seems like it's brave, but nobody knows what I have to deal with every day of my life still to this day, because I made the decision to stand up for myself when everybody else pretty much told me, with their actions and some with their words, we don't give a damn about what happens to you. Just keep your mouth closed. So that's my experience with trauma.
Monique, first yes. of all, I'm just yes. happy you're here with us to breathe right now in this moment, because that took a lot of bravery.
Yes, it did.
You know, honestly, that takes a lot of bravery, and to be able to tell your trauma story is just so powerful. And so I'm just taking it in with you right now in this moment, because to be able to sit back and take a look at self in comparison to how you have been manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
So that says a lot. Brother Josh Jermaine, do you have anything you want to say before I ask any question?
Oh no, I appreciate it. I love what you got. I appreciate you so much for you to be able to come on air and, you know, validate your story. You know, I think your story is going to be heard by the masses, you know, because I think this happened even from the most intense issues, from the smallest issues. Trauma silence is an issue, you know. So I'm so glad that you're on the show today to be able to express yourself honestly and know that you are being heard, you know, because you said a lot.
Yeah.
That was a breath.
I appreciate
you know what we say, what you breathe, you just had a whole breath right there. I mean, seriously, even to break it down on the, you know, even the beginning parts of saying, hey, my foundation was not solid. And so I did not even have the tools that others had coming up. And, you know, why were other kids protected and not me? What was the disconnect there? Right. You know, and then being ostracized, you know, these are different traumas. And I know what, for most of our viewers and if those who are not familiar, it's this thing called ACEs. And so each one of these traumas is another contributing factor to the outcome of your mental health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so it sounds like you beat the hell out of the odds and definitely very much resilient. So I want to.
I would like to thank them. I said, when you said that I beat the odds, I said I would like to thank them. There's like a little delay in my phone. So I apologize for that.
No problem, but you damn right. You beat the odds. And I know a person who beats the odds without having to see them, you know, just that vibe and understanding. And so, it's my Nick. I just got to say, I'm sorry that happened to you. I'm sorry that was your experience because you certainly didn't deserve that. And it really had me thinking about the morality and the moral development. Of those that were around you and the traumas they may have experienced, because this has been going on with a lot of people outside of you, which is even another trauma, because we learn from our internal family systems and we learn behaviors.
Right.
We learn how to cope. We learn how to deal with things. And so if acting like this did not happen is the coping mechanism you want me to utilize in dealing with not just this, but life, you're setting me up for failure. You know, so.
Exactly.
It would also help me to understand why, when this was happening to you morally as a young girl, one would not, like you said, remember that. This is more of a survival time, you know, but as an adult, well, becoming 16 years old, you know, your moral development is completely different. You know, this is the time where your identity is forming and you like, who am I and who are you?
Right.
And what are you doing? I'm questioning your integrity right now. I got sense enough to know better. And so that is also something that could drive one crazy when talking to those that are of an age, adult. And you saying to this adult, hey, this happened to me. Hell, you going to your mama or that trusted adult in your family, and if they're not able to protect you, what do you think that does to the morality and the psyche of one? How do you think that's going to protect you?
And can I say something about that? I would like to really touch on that because I had a few family members that actually said to me when I came to them, and then one of them, she came to me when I actually said that I felt offended that she didn't do anything when she was a victim as well. So I'll start with her. I remember talking to her. Well, I remember talking to my mother, and I kind of like went off. This was about 10 years ago. So I kind of just went off because I was, you know, I would have outbursts because it just wouldn't make sense to me in my mind how these people know what happened. And these people sit here and they constantly look at me and say, why can't you be quiet? Or what's wrong with you? As if they don't see what's happening, which is something that I find very, very weird. And so, excuse me, I told my mother, I said, you and everybody else who it happened to, this is also your fault. Because if you have told and said something, I mean, if you know that somebody is touching a child or doing something to a child, what is so wrong with now having that knowledge, telling the other adults who are letting children go over there, what's so wrong with saying, hey, I think we should find somewhere else for the children to go, or if you all need some help with this particular child, finding childcare for them or daycare or whatever, let's pitch in and, you know, send this child to daycare so they won't have to be subjected to this abuse. Or how about we let this child go over here to this other older person's house because we know they'll be safe over there. Nobody as an adult decided when I was younger and I told that there should have been something different going on when it came to sending children over there. My mother is 54. I'm 31. My oldest auntie probably would have been in her 60s. This has been happening in our family way before I was even born. So the way that I saw it when I was younger and found out that all these other people have been abused is there is no reason. There is no way possible for this to have, this should have ever had to touch a second generation. If this happened to so many people in the first generation and nobody did anything, nobody made any type of provisions to say, hey, we know this happened to us. And so because we don't want it to happen again, because we know how it messed us up, let's try and find other ways to deal with this situation. Because yes, my grandmother did have custody of me. Yes, my mother, you know, she was living her life. And so there should have been other things happening, not me continuing to be sent to a pedophile's house, because that's what he is. Somebody should have stood up and said, hey, we think that this is not a good situation because he did it to all these people. We just don't think it's smart. Nobody said anything. So then now when I bring this to people's attention, then I had to hear, well, I had my own family. That's what one of my aunts said to me. Excuse me? You had your own family? So am I not family? Am I not to be protected? Then I had another aunt who told me, well, I damn sure wouldn't send my grandkids over there, but it was okay for me to get sent over there. Because the last time I checked, I have two children myself. If anybody else's children are around me and I find out that something is happening, I am not going to close my mouth. And I'm going to make sure that I don't lay my head down at night not saying anything about this situation. And if I have to stop what I'm doing to babysit somebody else's child to make sure they don't go with a predator, that's what the hell I'm going to do. Or if I can't do that, I will contact the authorities because this is something that I wish somebody would have done for me. When I contacted the authorities, nothing happened because my family was so busy telling them that I was crazy, my grandmother. So to get that message that, well, I have my own family and this is okay for you to sit in my face and say, and you think that my mind is not going to think something is wrong with that. So that could have made me think about myself as low because of the way that other people responded to me. And they sent me an automatic message of, okay, well, I'm not important. Okay, well, my body doesn't matter. Okay, well, I must not be that important to them. And then by me already having abandonment issues from my mother, everybody else abandoned me in that situation. And then people wonder why I have such a hard time believing if people like me or if people really love me. Because what examples did I see growing up? That's all I saw. So that's the hard thing. That's a hard thing to have to look at yourself in the mirror and your reflection stares back at you and automatically seems, and it just automatically just says, I'm not worthy. I have to fight those types of thoughts. Even though I know now that I am, that it's still in the back of my mind. And I don't think that's something that will ever completely really go away. I think that it gets better. I have put systems into place so that when I do hear these things or feel this way, I know what to do. But I feel like I'm doing pretty well whether mm-hmm. I'm where people think I should be or whether I'm not. I think I'm doing a damn good job, considering that everybody dropped the ball when I was 16 and said, to hell with you, and we don't give a damn what happens to you. And I dare anybody in my family listen to argue, because then y'all going to have to meet me somewhere. Because everybody knows that's what's going to happen, because it's still happening.
Oh, wait, Miss Monique. No shots fired on the Black.
I went through that for way too many years with people trying to tell me I'm wrong for speaking up. How? That does not make any sense to me. And then they look at me and think I'm the one that's, it just doesn't make sense to me. It's the crazy making behavior that I have a problem with, because people always want to be in my life in this family, but yet and still they never acknowledge the pain that I went through based on what they caused me, but they don't want me to talk about it. So that's why I said what I said. I'm not trying to be violent. But if anybody has an issue, they know what to do. And that's that.
Look, Miss Monique, and you know what? I'm gonna second that and say that's that too. Because that is that. I had a question come in and someone wanted to know, did the guy ever apologize, and did you ever get closer and closer to them in your life? Like, was he able to say sorry or to admit his wrongdoing to you?
I want to thank the person who asked that question. He did. But the way that he did it was, he's Lutheran. And so all of these years that I had been telling, I addressed him and I told on him, nothing happened. Then all of a sudden he gets older and gets sick. And he wants to apologize to me because he told his pastor what happened. And when you tell a clergy member what happened, they're mandated reporters, just like therapists, doctors, and teachers, and things like that. So his pastor, or whatever you call him, priest or whatever, he told him that he had to make things right with me. So Richard called my grandmother, who did not ask me, but she gave him my number when I was 20 years old. And he called me one night, and it shocked me to my core. I almost passed out because I saw the number pop up. And so I answered the phone. He said, hello, Ashley. This is, his name. And I said, okay. And he said, I wanted to apologize to you for what I did to you. Would you be willing to meet with me and my pastor? And I was like, whoa. So, because I had been trying to get justice for myself for years and being called crazy, ostracized, all these things that I went through nonstop. Nonstop, walking the streets at night sometimes because I couldn't even stay at home because I was getting bullied by my grandmother for telling. And family members wouldn't even let me come and stay in their houses at night. Y'all remember that too. And so when I got there to the church and when we met, he apologized to me, but he tried to play a mental, he tried to play a mind game with me. He said, can you tell me what I did to you? I'm not an idiot. So I knew he was trying to re-traumatize me. So I said, no, I'm not going to do that. You know exactly what you did to me because you're the one that caused this meeting. There's nothing wrong with your brain yet just because you're that old. You know exactly what happened. And so he got himself together. He admitted what he did. I had a question, though. I said, did my family allow you to do these things to us? Because in my mind, it made sense. Did they trade you for the... I literally said this to him. And I have witnesses. Did my family, my grandmother, trade us for the things that you can do for him? For the things that you could do for them? He told me yes. I called my grandmother and I cursed her out. Because in that moment, you don't know what that did to me. To hear for all those years that I was crazy, that tried to get me into an institution, tried to get me put on medication, telling people, slandering me to the point where people still meet me and get to know me. And they say, I knew that your family wasn't telling the truth about you, or I thought you were crazy all these years because of what your family said about you. I still have to deal with that. So, yes, I called my grandmother and I cussed her out. And you know what my grandmother said to me when I confronted her about what he said to me about what they let happen? She said, I'm sorry. She didn't say you lying. Mm. She didn't say he was lying. She said, I'm sorry. So I called my two aunties, one of them who's married to him. They didn't answer the phone. I didn't want to leave a voicemail. I wanted them to get it hot off the press. So I just hung up the phone. I didn't even try again. But I have cussed them out on occasions as well because I'm tired of the narrative going around that Monique is crazy. That's not how this is going to keep going. And people are seeing that now, but it's not enough to where this man was able to make this right and everybody, and I'm vindicated in the eyes of everybody, which I don't really need, but the damage that they did, it's a lot in the eyes of other people when it concerns my character. But the thing that people really can see is after he did that, after we had that meeting, he had 24 hours to turn himself in because he just admitted to a crime. And the statute, I was within the statute of limitations. So he turned himself in. I got a phone call from a victim advocate who was able to walk through the process with me and explain everything to me. And over a process of that summer when I was 21 until about January of 2012, because it happened in 2011, 6 months later, he was charged with fourth-degree sexual assault of a minor. His wife, my auntie, showed up to court with him and had the nerve to tell the sheriff or whatever that she didn't want to walk in or out of the courtroom anywhere near me as if she had been abused by me. And in this situation, I'm the child. I'm the kid. And you sat here and told these people that you wanted me to walk out first or walk in first because you didn't want me to be around you. You didn't want me around you? Like, really? That was really deep. My whole family knew about the court date. Nobody came. Nobody said anything. My grandmother, we didn't talk about anything. Actually, before the court date, he called my grandmother and asked her for help with certain dates because she was in the hospital when he did this to me when I was 16 and I had to go stay with him. So she actually assisted him in his process of the court and giving the dates. And then she called me to confirm the date of when he molested me to help him. So the whole time that I went through all of this stuff, I went through it all by myself. None of my family members stood up with me. There is no excuse for it because if I could do it and I was on my own, as far as I was 16 and nobody was really taking care of me, nobody was there for me, my grandmother stopped taking care of me financially, wouldn't buy me clothes, anything, all because I decided to tell on him. My whole family turned their backs on me. And when it was proven in court and he admitted it out of his own mouth, I still, and was even worse, looked at it as if I was the perpetrator, not him. So, yeah, he did apologize. And no, I don't have close relationships with my family. Yeah, and I don't have close relationships. Right.
Hell, how could you? After that, I think that it would be definitely a long time and a lot of accountability before we can get to that. I just really wanted to make sure you was able to get that out because that's some messed up stuff right there. And like I said, just again, what in the heck? What kind of bamboozlement is that? Listen, you guys, we at the top of the hour. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to come right back and get back into this discussion and hear a little bit from our viewers. I appreciate you guys being here with us on Black Sister Talk.
Thank you.
Kendrick Lamar. Two first names, huh? What the fuck is up with that? You know what DNA stands for? Dead Nigger Association. Yeah.
News on police brutality with that line in the song. And we hate the popo. Want to kill us in the street?
I got loyalty, got royalty inside my DNA. Cocaine quarter piece, got war and peace inside my DNA. I got power, poison, pain, and joy inside my DNA. I got hustle, though, ambition, flow inside my DNA. I was born like this, immaculate conception.
should not transform like this, perform like this. What shouts you a new weapon? I don't contemplate, I meditate. Then off your fucking head. This that put the kids to bed. This that I got realness. I just kill shit cause it's in my DNA. I got millions, I got riches building in my DNA. I got dark, I got evil that rot inside my DNA. I got off, I got trouble, some heart inside my DNA. I just win again, then win again like Wimbledon I serve. Yeah, that's him again, the sound, the engine in is like a bird. You see fireworks and Corvette tire skirt, the boulevard. I know how you work, I know just who you are. See, use a bitch, your arm on probably switch inside your DNA. Problem is, all that sucker shit inside your DNA. Daddy probably snitch, heritage inside your DNA. Backbone don't exist, burn on side a jellyfish, I gauge. See, my pedigree most definitely don't tolerate the front. Shit I been through probably offend you, this is Parler's oldest son. I know murder, conviction, furnace, boosters, burglars, ballers, dead. Redemption, scholars, fathers, dead. With kids and I wish I was fed. Forgiveness, yeah. Soldier's DNA, born inside the beast. My expertise checked out in second grade. When I was 9, on sale motel, we didn't have nowhere to stay. At 29, I've been so well, hit cartwheel in my estate. And I'm gonna shine like I'm supposed to. Antisocial, extrovert. And excellence mean an extra work. And absentness, what the fuck you hurt? And passiveness never struck my nerve. And that's a riff from the pleader's case. The reason my power's here. Salute the truth from the prophet, see. Back my nigga, so you better go harder. Fuck what they talking about, this shit is worth. Another dead nigga association.
I got loyalty, got royalty inside my DNA.
I got loyalty, got royalty inside my DNA.
I got loyalty, got royalty inside my DNA. This is my heritage, I'm inheriting money and power, the maker, I'm meritorious. Tell me something, you motherfuckers can't tell me nothing. I'd rather die than to listen to you. My DNA not for imitation, your DNA an abomination. This how I just when you in the matrix, dodging bullets, reaping what you're sowing, stacking up the footage, living on the go and sleeping in the villa, sipping from a clammy, walking in the building, diamond in the ceiling, marble on the floors, peaches out the window, peeking out the window, baby in the pool, godfather calls, only Lord knows. I've been going hammer, dodging paparazzi, freaking through the cameras, eating four daughters, Brock wearing sandals, yoga on the Monday, stretching to the Vanna, watching all the snakes, curving all the fakes, phone never owned, I don't care a cent, I don't compromise, I just penetrate. Sex, money, murder, these are the breaks, these are the times. Level number 9, look up in the sky, tennis on the way, tennis on the way, tennis on the way. Motherfucker, I got winners on the way. You ain't shit without a buddy on your belt. You ain't shit without a ticket on your plate. You ain't sick enough to put it on yourself. You ain't rich enough to hit the light escape. Tell me when destruction gonna be my fate. Gonna be our fate. Let it rotate. Sex, money, murder, IDNA.
Nigga in my DNA. Uh-huh. Ain't no hoe inside my DNA. Uh-huh. Dripping gold inside my DNA. Uh-huh. Power shows inside my DNA. DNA. Uh-huh. Real nigga in my DNA. Uh-huh. Ain't no hoe inside my
DNA.
No more drama in my life. No one's gonna make.
so tired.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Welcome back, welcome back. Black Sister Talk, where you can breathe. So far, the show has been going well, and I just have to thank Ms. Monique. I can't thank her enough for just coming on the show and expressing herself in the way she has been so raw and challenged. And so I appreciate you for coming on and sharing your story. Quickly, we're going to go over the top of the hour lineup. This is time for an Awakening Media lineup. On Mondays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., we have African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds host Brother Jihad Ahmad. 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., we have Black Therapy Central. Black Therapy Central host Dr. Mawaya Cambone and Sister Natasha Cambone. From 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., we have Conversation Reparations. This occurs every first and third Monday. Tuesdays from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, we have Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. Thursdays, we have from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. After 7, host Shani B. Friday, we have 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Time for an Awakening. And around Saturday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we have Black Sister Talk, host Rwanda Chambers, co-host Brother Josh Jermaine. 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, we have the Elders of Sankofa, host Alfonso Watkins. And Sundays from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., we have Time for an Awakening. Please do check out our other shows on our network. They're all awesome. Everybody got some cool Black African American flavor for you, and I hope you like it and check it out. So we're going to get right back into today's topic. Stop trauma silencing our children. Looking at everything that Ms. Monique has shared up until this point, I just have to say, even when one is forced to take accountability, that is oftentimes a challenge. And it's amazing to hear how the family seem to protect this person who should have been ostracized versus the child. You should have been protected. And so I apologize for them. If they have not apologized to you, that's horrible, horrible experience. Oh, anytime, sister. We have to take ownership and speak up for those who are wrong to give you the strength and validate you and let you know you're not crazy. This is being told, you're crazy over and over again, when you should not be crazy, and you are not crazy for not consenting to be traumatized, to not consent to being molested. You didn't consent to that. So for that alone, you know, there's no issue with morality there. I'm going to open up the line so we can hear from our listeners, just to see if they have any questions. And then if not, you and I and Brother Josh Jermaine will continue to engage in our dialogue. I just want to make sure everybody has the opportunity to share on the line, okay? Thank you, Ms. Money. 414-759-1108. How you doing?
Hi, Ms. Chambers. Hi, Josh Jermaine. Hello, how are you guys doing?
Good, Ms. Lanny. I done gave your whole number out. You're going to have some fan calls.
I'm sorry. To say my hat's off to Ms. Monique. I am so happy that you told. Never let anyone tell you that you are wrong. Because ultimately what happened was, you know, even nobody stepped up to help you, God saw it all. So he had to reveal it on himself. Mm-hmm. And not trying to get biblical on anybody, but when God makes things happen, it's for the good of us, and it's going to be done the right way. Your family is not the only one that have these secrets in it. I have a family that have secrets in them, where you got the mom, got their daughters, 12-year-old, marrying these grown men. That's right. I don't care if it is you giving consent. That's right. So now, years later, they got 18 kids. He way up in his 90s, almost 100, and she just in her 60s. You get what I'm saying? It's right. Yeah. But they do it for self gratification. It's something in it for them, and not looking at the trauma and all the issues that's going to be caused for that individual because of what they want out of the deal. It's wrong. Your family is wrong. Never let them make you feel like you did anything wrong, because what you did opened up a door to help out things that help them. Even though they didn't come forward, your word, and you're revealing what has happened. Because there's statute of limitation on everything, but one thing about that, there's no limitation on that. And it helped to, for things that happened to them, even though they didn't come to your rescue. I ask that you pray for them, and I pray for you that God grants you peace with this. I can't say you're going to never forget it, because it's always embedded, because how it happened, to what magnitude it happened, to the labeling, the ostracizing, all of that in itself was a lot. I have a friend I'm going to share with you and all the listeners. I have a friend that I grew up with in the South. She had a mother, raised in a single parent home. Mom would always leave her home with this boyfriend. And it was like the boyfriend would always send mom on these missions to go do things because he was at this daughter. And she only could confide in me before she confided in, you know, her grandparents. So every time she would leave, he would make his advances. Or she told me that at nighttime, she would hear him coming. She would jump into bed with her brother and wrap her legs around her brother's waist so he wouldn't mess with her. So to speed up the process on that, she had had about enough. She packed up this little bag, hit the gangway, ran to her grandparents' house. Told grandmother. They believed her out the gate. There was no doubt about it in their mind. They believed her. And they summoned him and my mother. My mother. They summoned him and this girl's mother, because she's my godmother. To come and see them. So the grandfather told the man, whoever the man was, he said, I'm hearing things and I'm not liking what I'm hearing about what you're going to do to this child, which is happened to be his granddaughter. He said, but there's one more thing that I have to hear about this situation. And he pointed in the corner of the wall, he kept a shotgun. And he pointed in that corner and he told him, he said, you see that weapon over there? If I hear something else about this situation, or if it comes to me and my wife about this situation, it's going to be dealt with. Do I make myself clear? So I asked her, I was like, so your mom didn't believe you? She was like, no. I kept telling my mom. She wouldn't say nothing. I said, God, mama used to believe everything people say. She was like, well, in this case, she did not believe what I was telling her, because she was so in love with this man. He had none of the kids were his. None of them. They all had different dads. So, and at that point, she was so traumatized by of the thought of what he was going to do because he kept making sending the mom on these missions. She decided to move in with my with the grandmother, and the grandmother and the grandfather allowed her to stay. There she stayed forever. So let's flip the script a little further. So he tried at that age, and I think she was like 12, 13 around that time. So not too much older than you. So let's move on a little further. So long down the line, godmother and this guy broke up. She moved out of town. This girl continues to stay with her grandparents. So now she's an adult. She's 18, 19. This same predator, study lurking, trying to get her, trying to sell her, you know, I can buy you this, I can do this and do that. So the grandmother spotted him one day. She said she came out and told him that the same thing that my husband told you many years ago, it still exists. I still have that same shotgun. You better get away from my house. So I say that to you is, you continue to tell your story because you don't know who out here that you are helping, because everybody don't have a voice. And because so many black families, and I'm going to say black families because my family is black, I'm black. You know, they teach their children what goes on in our house, what goes on in the family stays in the family. But at some point, when it's something to this magnitude, that shouldn't be the topic of discussion of silencing a child to tell what's going on. So then at that point, you shutting them down. And if anything else is happening to them, they feel like you're not going to believe them, or you're not going to listen to nothing that they're going to say. And then you want to make up these fabricated stories like they lying, want to tell a doctor and say, talking about they crazy. You want to put them on these medications. Society is already against us enough. But to have your family to do these type of things to you is totally wrong. And I say to you and my friend, because we're still friends to this day. We've been friends for 30-some years. She still deals with it. She still deals with it. And she's so protected when it comes to her children, because she will not bring anybody around her children because she just don't know, and she don't want them to be put in that position that she was almost in. Now, luckily, she got out because she did have somebody to believe in her, because had she not had anybody believe in her, then he would have had his way with her.
Yeah.
He would have had his way. And it's so much sex trafficking out here in our communities, that they're doing these things to our young children. Some of the, you know, the communities, families, what have you, are turning a blind eye to it because they don't want to get involved. My thing is, why not get involved? You help out. I don't care if I'm not related to that. I'm not going to stand back and watch nobody do that to nobody's children, male or female, because it ain't just females that this is happening to. So I say to you, honey, I salute you.
Thank you.
I'm gonna pray for you. It took courage for you to do that, because it took me back to my childhood memory with my friend, and it was hard for her to tell me because she didn't have nowhere to go. She didn't have nobody to believe in her. And like I said, when people have ulterior motives and it's something out of the deal that they're benefiting from, then they're going to silence everybody in the family because they don't want to cut off the benefits. But at whose expense is it worth it for? Because look at what it has done to you. But one thing I do know is made you stronger, because I heard the strength in your voice when you were talking about it. It has made you stronger to even share your story. That's your story. And that is your truth. And you tell your truth regardless of who believes. Because one thing about it, the Lord up above believes you, honey. He sees everything. He knows everything. And honey, when he's working it out, he gonna work it out for your good, no matter what. You see what the outcome was. You didn't have to say a word. You didn't have to say a word, but you came out on the victorious end for everybody that this man has done some things to, even though they didn't come to your aid.
Exactly.
So I salute you.
Exactly.
And you continue talking. And you continue encouraging. Tell it, because you don't know who you're going to touch that's going through that.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Well,
I really appreciate
it. Thank you for sharing, Miss Lenny. Yeah, you know, I can't say to you time and time again. I cannot stress to you guys how everybody is growing and going through their own things, and so you just had the strength to speak up, and I just wonder about those who hadn't spoken up and how that had affected them keeping their secret for so long. You know, this is like one of those dirty little secrets that you just throw and try to bury because it puts a scarlet letter on your identity. So, you just got to breathe and understand that battle is not yours. I'm going to go to another caller we have on the line, 678-206. Hello, would you like to chime in?
Yeah, right there. I like that song.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Hello?
Hi, caller 678-206. Would you like to chime in on the conversation? Okay, maybe they're just listening. Brother Joshua, man, you got anything you want to chime in before we get back into our discussion? Okay. So, we have given our viewers the opportunity.
I'm here. I was saying that I'm glad to hear Miss Lady's story and to hear Monique's story, though, about what
I'm like, I can't hear a damn thing you're saying. What do you want to mute?
I think Monique and Ms. Lainey, I'm so thankful and appreciative of y'all sharing y'all story, you know, especially on air, because I know people need to hear it, and I agree with LaWanda 100%. What about the ones that never had a voice, you know? They don't want that to even have the strength to even say stop. You know what I mean? Not even saying strength, saying you're not going to stop or not, but them not having that voice, can you just imagine just how much, you know, they don't believe in themselves, their low self-esteem, their trust issues, being gaslighted all the time. That's gaslight to extreme. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying, though? And that makes you start not believing yourself. You start thinking you really are going crazy. You know what I'm saying? And I think the second thing on my end, just being a male on a woman platform where everybody's expressing it, it made me look at myself as a man and say, men are protecting or are they really protecting? Because where were these men? You know, all these men in the family, and he wanted to protect them, want to make sure they're good. Where is that protection on their end? You know, so it's a critical, honest critique on my end, just being in the middle, just hearing that. Because most of the time, though, when the abuse is going down, I mean, from the stories I heard, it's the men doing it. You know, even though men are being victimized, even as kids, but it just, as a man, it just made me look at things from a reality perspective, just to know that this is a big problem, and us not talking about it is not going to fix it.
Yeah, but you know what? I got to let you know this. I'm glad you're here to take some responsibility, but I think it also speaks to the whole family unit. You know, how can a Black woman feel protected when our own families do not protect us? Meaning, more than likely, as a woman, we're going to feel more comfortable going to our grandmother or our mother or auntie or something. We're not really going to go to an uncle or cousin, a male cousin, at least, if something was to happen to us as a child, as a young woman. So to go to the women and get that kind of feedback, you know, they teaching us socially how to be in the household, and it seems like everybody has sent a message that what goes on in this house stays in this house, no matter how bad it is, how nasty it sounds. Mm-hmm. We a family and we're gonna stick together. And I say, yeah, it's cool to be a family and stick together, but those who are doing wrong to other family members, they have to be held accountable. And if that's ostracizing and not going to CPS and doing what you need to do, you at least need to make sure that stuff is not happening. I'm not saying that that's the best way to handle it, but as a mental health practitioner, it's been a lot of times where children are telling these stories and it's just not enough details given to make those reporters being mandated reporters. So it is very challenging and hard to bring some peace to these children who are experiencing this type of trauma. And so to hear you say, well, I was trying to get other people to corroborate my story, it just sheds light, like, okay, I'm telling you this is my truth and no one is believing me because the adults and authority figures in my life are telling you something's wrong with me.
Yeah.
So now your credibility is out the window.
All the way.
Mm-hmm. Your inner dialogue is traumatizing because now you're building an inner dialogue to yourself. You know, we all got a dialogue that we tell ourselves, and sometimes that's being built by how people around us is talking about us. You know what I'm saying? Or how people responding to us. So now you having self-negative talk now, you know? And then now you're negative talking to yourself now because now you're saying, like, who am I? You know what I'm saying? Then you go down a downward spiral and you got these adults around you as kids that's supposed to pick you up and they kicking you down. And then you want to be able to respect them.
What you're getting at, no, I'm listening to you. I just want to chime in really quickly because what you're explaining is just what the brain does. The brain does just what it's designed to do, and that's to think. And we have to understand that when our brain is thinking, we're going to have these random negative thoughts, these random positive thoughts. But see, what happens is when we're having these experiences, these traumas, this is contributing to those self-fulfilling prophecies. This is contributing to that confidence. That's contributing to my identity, who I am, what I'm going to be, how I'm going to be there. You know, and to be honest, it's contributing to depression. That's the very beginning of that. That's the manifestations of this depression. And so I wonder, just through treatment and getting help throughout this entire process, do you feel that the labels, did you feel that those labels placed upon you have overridden the cultural manifestations when given a diagnosis? And I think that we touched basis on this a little bit in our conversation when we were just speaking a lot more about cultural responsibility of treating African Americans who have experienced these types of traumas. You know, paying attention to what these ACE assessments are and all of these different trauma scales being used. Use those not only for prescribing, but also use them for treatment and understanding why this diagnosis is here instead of just, oh, well, this is what I see in front of me. Let's look at what's underneath. We're always talking about underlying needs, and that trauma is an underlying need that has to be met.
Right. If I may say something.
Absolutely.
Okay. So I have, I'll just share just a little bit about my experience with those types of things. I, aside from being predisposed to mental health issues or mental health disorders, just like a lot of people are, because it runs in their families, when you have trauma, especially at a very early age, it can exacerbate those already predisposed genes or genetics and cause a person to have a breakdown or to just really snap, because that trauma is so hard on the brain, on the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And for me personally, that's pretty much what happened to me. I don't really agree with some of the diagnosis, because I've been doing my own self-work and I've been doing it for like over 10 years. I would say about 10 years, 10 or 11 years. And with me doing the work that I do on my own,
which is a lot of just inner reflection, analyzing, taking accountability, responsibility. And I always want to be fair to people, and I don't like to get over on people. You know, as far as me knowing that I need certain things emotionally, I don't want to put that off on others, which I have in the past. And so me just being responsible, I wanted to make sure that I was not continuing when I got a certain age to act out due to my experiences. And so even though I was diagnosed with certain things, I got those things under control, which let me know that medication was not the way to go for me, because I was acting out of a place of being hurt, being traumatized, being abandoned, as well as a lot of other things. And once I got a lot of the negative self-talk under control, once I started pointing the finger in the right direction instead of looking at myself, not that I want to point fingers, but just to look at the situation for what it really was. My family allowed this. So being super hard on myself and trying to force myself to be okay, even though I know that I'm not okay, that really caused my mind to really break as well, because I was not acknowledging or giving myself the credit for having survived those things. And then the way that people were treating me, it just made me feel like, well, they already think I'm crazy, I'm just going to snap, you know, and then I would just become really aggressive because I didn't have a voice, really. It's just a lot of different factors. But I really believe that the psychiatry world needs to really take a much more honed in look on trauma, which they have, but they don't really acknowledge it to the degree that I feel that I personally feel like they should. And the reason why I say that is because I go to the doctor, and even when I would go and see therapists, the first thing they would do after the second appointment is want to prescribe me a medication based off of my symptoms, not unpack the trauma. Yeah, the medication could possibly work for me, but I know that for me, I needed to talk these things out, because I had went through this stuff for so many years, and I was just going and going and going, and I was just on autopilot. I was just making it. I was just getting through it. I was surviving, I guess. And then once I got to a point where I was able to sit down and I didn't have so much chaos going on around me, that's when I just lost it. But I still picked myself up from that. And I'm not saying everybody can do it, so I don't want to send that message out there that if you went through something that you don't need medication. Some people do need medication to cope with what they're going through until they're strong enough to do it. I didn't take that route. I didn't feel like I needed it, because I knew what was wrong with me. What was wrong with me was my family. Now that I've gotten away from my family, I have considered, and I actually have been on medication so that I could get myself to a place to allow my mind to have a break. Because my mind was trying to figure all these things out. Then I also had to acknowledge now, because I didn't want to abuse the medication. So then I had to get to a point where I started to really be real in therapy so that I could be self-sufficient as far as with my mood, with my highs and lows, with the depression, with the anxiety. And I had to just accept. That's another thing, acceptance. I had to accept that I went through some very, very, very traumatic experiences the majority of my life. And for me to think I should be a certain way is unfair to myself. So I had to really be honest. I had to be gentle. I had to be understanding. And I had to practice a lot of self-love, because I was gone. My mind had just slipped. And nobody really knew it, because I was living on my own with my son. But it's just that when I would get behind closed doors, I just really couldn't function. And then holidays come around, and it's like that's really still hard, because all of the memories of, oh, we're getting ready to go to this house person's house, but you can't come. Or, oh, well, you know, we came back from this person's house and everybody's eating, but nobody bothered to bring me anything to eat. It's little petty stuff like that. So this whole mental health thing, trauma needs to be, to me, my opinion, trauma needs to be brought more to the forefront instead of just trying to prescribe medication and coping strategies, coping skills, and then giving people a voice. That's how mm-hmm. I feel about it. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And you kind of got ahead of me, because the question I was going to ask you is, having experienced this, right, Were there any coping strategies you wanted to share with any other victims who may have experienced trauma silencing? Is there any advice you would want to let them have at this moment?
Sure. The things that I personally, that I started to, I've been going through things since I was pretty young. So I learned, and I think it also has something to do with my personality. I learned to really, I learned to write my feelings out. And I am a writer. I write poems and things like that. So I learned to just really feel my inner self. I really learned to sit with my emotions. That was really a coping skill for me because I was the only person around me who validated my feelings. So it was really important to me to have me time for me to spend by myself. I took baths, and I'm not going to lie, I would get some roses, rose petals, not when I was young, of course, but when I got to be an adult, I got rose petals, candles, and I would do things really, really nice for myself. I would treat myself really, really nice and really gentle. I started to do deep breathing. I started to practice yoga, meditation. I also started listening to music, but it's really important what type of music you listen to. Music that's going to feed your soul, that's positive, that's sending positive self-love messages. I listen to classical music. I also love to walk because trauma has a physical effect on the body. And so it's very important mm-hmm. to get a lot of those feelings, a lot of that anger out. And so even if you're not actually playing the sport, even if you're not able to exercise, you know, walking just like a couple blocks back and forth a day can really help release a lot of that negative energy that's in the body that, you know, that trauma brings to a person. Talking to a therapist helped me. That was a good coping strategy. Finding safe people that I know that I could trust. Now, everybody may not have the awareness of who they can trust because you've been through trauma. It does cause you to sometimes be a little bit paranoid of other people, especially if you had experiences like mine where people didn't believe you. And then some people would listen to me and act like they believe me, but then they would talk about me and I would later find out. And it would make me feel like I can't trust people. And with your story, you do have to be careful with who you trust. So things like that. I tried a support group. I was pretty good with that, but I'm an introvert, so I'm not really that people-friendly as far as social. And if you have a support system, like the woman that called earlier, I really appreciated hearing her story about her friend, and I really hope that her friend is able to find peace in her life today because she did have support, but even still with support, it's still really hard. So if you do have a support system, if it's safe and if you feel safe, lean on them as much as possible if you know that they are there for you because you cannot do it by yourself. I've been doing it by myself, and it's not easy. It's not easy at all. So if you do have a support system, please let people be there for you. If you need to cry, please, please cry because the emotional body, that energetic being within that's in all of us that we all have, that part of you can become very cloudy and it can harden your heart if you don't let this stuff out. So crying and emotional releases is another coping skill. So that's pretty much all I can say about that.
Oh, no, thank you, Ms. Monique. I wanted you to share that because coming from you and listeners hearing, like, hey, this has been my journey. This is what has helped. Mm-hmm. It's really, really going to be helpful. You know, just mm-hmm. giving them the breath of life right now and saying, hey, you can talk about this. It's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And it really has a lot to do with your mindset, your thinking. You're wanting to come up out of it as well and figuring out mm-hmm. how you're going to move on. So I know there have been a lot of internal battles one had to overcome. Just mm-hmm. living. Who am I? My identity is always at stake. And so
yeah.
You're so strong. You know, you're so resilient mm-hmm. and you're so mm-hmm. blessed. You know, and I'm just so happy you came up out of it. All the stories that have been shared on this line this evening have been powerful. I definitely got to thank Ms. Laney for sharing that information because these things continue yeah. to go on. These things are happening right now on the fifth row of the church where we coming in mm-hmm. there every Sunday, sitting down, you know, praising the Lord and the hallelujah. We're giving our kids false ideas about their identity, their religion, and who they are. Who they mm-hmm. are is so much a part of who you are, who your mother is, what you see your mother doing. Mm-hmm. If you see your mother lying all the time, guess what? You're going to be a damn liar. That's it, because that's all you've been, that's what you've been taught to do. We're taught that this mm-hmm. dysfunction, and we've talked about this on the show a couple of weeks ago, but this is a prime example of a dysfunctional family and generational trauma continuing to exist because this has been the norm. I'm not trying to throw my down south people under the bus, but we got to be real and understanding that there had been a migration that occurred. And during that time, during that upbringing down south, molesting your cousin or your sister or your whatever, this was mm-hmm. fair game. This was a part of life. You know what I'm saying? And that came with them to the north. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. those same people moved too. And that stuff continued to go on because guess what? It happened in the barn, so it can happen in the basement in Chicago, or it can happen in the attic over here in Milwaukee or whatever the case may be. This shit is happening, and our kids are being affected, and love is lost, and all kind of corruption is occurring, and everybody wondering, why is this so? Why is this so? Well, take some damn responsibility, because you are just mm-hmm. as much the problem as the person who has committed this monstrosity. Okay? Yeah.
You know,
that's what I got to say about it.
That's so true.
Go in on that. And I think on my end, I think the one thing I think about is the Black community of how we even look at mental illness, let alone stigmas, let alone knowing what trauma is. You know, we in the Black community, most people probably think trauma is just putting a Band-Aid over it and think it's going to heal on its own. And, you know, it's going to go back mm-hmm. to normal. You know what I'm saying? Like, these are responses in our body that never goes back to a normal state ever. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, we just can't keep saying, oh, it's going to be okay, or be quiet about it, you know, because eventually, though, the sad part is these kids become adults, and then they end up having kids. And then we finally going back to another generational curse, another generational trauma, you know. It's like, I agree with you, Monique, 110%, that we need to define what trauma really means, because, I mean, let's be real, most times we in denial in the Black community about what trauma is anyway, let alone what mental illnesses are, mental disorders. We just labeling things and not really knowing what we're talking about.
Trauma for us in the Black community is just a way of life. See, it is not existing because this is your norm. Therefore, every day living in poverty is trauma. Every day I'm living in poverty. Most of these people living with roaches, rats, bed bugs, the whole nine, landlord not coming to fix nothing. I mean, this is trauma every single day. And so when this becomes your norm, shit, you just get through it because this is survival. And so if we gotta understand there are other ways to survive. Okay, we have to disrupt this system and recognize that this is not normal. This is not okay. And goddammit, you don't have to make it normal. Okay, that's the thing. You can decide. There is a choice that can be made right now.
Yeah, that is so true. You'll be surprised at how many people have told me things like, well, you're not the only person who went through it, or it wasn't that bad because things happened worse to other people. And I'm like, so did you just tell me, when I told you what happened to me, that it's not that bad because it didn't happen the way it happened to somebody else, or because it happened to so many other people, excuse me, that I should just be okay with it? Like, what are you trying to say? Well, what they're trying to say is, all of us made it and it happened to us, so who are you? Somebody actually said, what makes you so special that anybody should care about what you're going through? What type of shit is that?
My thing is this, why the hell do we have to be so goddamn strong, but if it was someone else, oh, poor is me, poor you, poor this, but because I'm a Black woman, okay, I'm supposed to be able to take it. See, the point I was going to make about what you were saying just a minute ago, Brother Joshua, man, is see, socially, Black men, they're going to respond in anger. Black women are going to respond by picking up shutting the fuck up and doing what they got to do. Mm-hmm. That's how Black women are survived. Okay? And that's not surviving. That's not, we need to stop worrying about surviving and focus on living. We're not breathing. Yeah, right. We're dealing with heart disease. We're dealing with all kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yep.
We're dealing with issues. And if we don't start educating ourselves, we're going to have more issues than this. I feel like me and the sister talked about culturally responsible treatment for African Americans and looking at that diet, you know, looking at other things that bring our balance and get us recalibrated. Because this knowledge is out there. We have to be willing to seek it out and find it, because there are other things that we need to be doing to make sure our vibration is where they need to be at. Okay. And if that was addressed, some of these mental health issues wouldn't be so prevalent.
Right. That's true.
Understanding you. And I mean, we're going to talk about this life path in a few weeks.
That's right.
And breaking down a little bit more on these topics that segue into this, because it's not just one thing. This is a multidisciplinary approach. This is a situation where we have to have our hands on deck. And trauma is definitely the foundation.
Yeah.
Don't get it twisted.
That's real. And I think next week, though, eventually we get the life path going, I think the trauma is good, because it's all about how we perceive what this trauma is and what does it look like. You know, and sometimes, though, I think it's great that we got a platform we can talk about, you know, realistic issues, but we can also mix in some of that mystical work in there, mix in some of that astrology life path, though, because it's just not out here just saying it because we want to talk about it and be popular. I mean, some of that stuff, though, can help us understand why this stuff happened to us. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes we need a validation to know why it's going on to us and only us, you know, instead of always feeling like everything on the outside. Because you know what they say, what's on the outside, it comes within. You know what I mean? So it's all about how we perceive in our own self. We having the spiritual experiences in our body. We got to know where it's coming from. And sometimes they can give us that testimony, help us heal. You know, we want to heal more. And I think that's a great thing, too. So it's great to incorporate the real-life issues that's really going on and try to give a higher perspective about things as well.
Yeah, just imagine what that kind of insight will do. That type of insight helps you to understand and gives you validation when making certain kinds of decisions. You know how you say, something ain't right about this person. But you still go ahead and engage. And then it's not until something happens that you feel validated in that moment. So this life path is going to give you some validation and purpose and understanding. And so that's going to be a blessing to have, because everybody got this thing where if it's normal, they worried about being normal. I worry about being my damn self. I worry about being my authentic self at all times. Let me let you know. Mm-hmm. I do not be worried about this or that. I'm going to speak my mind because I'm a Black woman and that's who I am. And anybody got an issue with that, then so be it. But I'm going to speak my mind because we have been silenced and unheard enough. And so if I got to stand on Mount Rushmore and say it so damn loud that we create some sort of avalanche or some sort of cracking of the earth, then I broke some damn ground today. Okay? That's how I'm going to be. Miss Monique, I just got to let you know I appreciate you coming on to talk with us today, and I want you to know you are welcome to come back on the show anytime. This is an open platform where we have these discussions, very open, very, very radical, and I want you to know you're always welcome here to discuss whatever, whenever.
And also, Monique, though, please let everybody know where they can find you, you know, on social media.
Okay. My Instagram page is at Monique, M-O-N. It's My Divinity is Within 8909. And then on YouTube, it's My Divinity is Within. So that's how you can find me on social media.
Yes, ma'am. We're going to check you out and go ahead and like, follow, and subscribe. I will be doing so right after this show, because guess what? We're going to become a patron of Ms. Monique. Your story was very powerful, and I just appreciate you for sharing it. thank you all. Thank you all for listening. I hope that you were able to take something from this conversation and help, if not yourself, someone you may know, because this is happening and we ought to be, it's a duty for us to be the change we want to be, especially with this upcoming election. Y'all out here worried about voting and hitting that, checking that box on the ballot and this kind of shit going on in your house. Come on now. We got to get our priorities in order too. Let me let you know.
That is so true. You better tell them.
Choose to live.